In Amos chapter 3 and in verse 3, God makes an observation that should just be common knowledge to us. The New American Standard renders it this way: do two men walk together unless they have made an appointment? It's a rhetorical question. Two people don't walk together and travel to the same place unless they have first gotten together and discussed what their plan is going to be. Some of the older translations render this same verse as, can two walk together except they be agreed? The idea within this statement, within this concept that the Lord is putting out here that should be just well accepted, is that in order for there to be any amount of cooperation between individuals, any amount of acting together towards a common goal, there first has to be some discussion, some dialogue, and some agreement made about what we're going to do, what's going to happen, and how it's going to be done. And so we see here this principle that effective communication is foundational to meaningful relationships. In fact, I would say that it is one of the keys, if not the key, to healthy relationships. If we don't know how to effectively communicate with one another, we're not going to be able to interact with one another or engage with one another in very meaningful ways. We're not going to be able to really come to know one another if we can't communicate well with one another. We're not going to be able to grow together with one another. And I would contend that at the root of almost all bad or poor or dysfunctional relationships, I think if you trace it down towards its roots, you're going to find that there is a lack of clear and honest communication between the parties. In fact, the source of much conflict, even within what we might think of as healthy relationships, is rooted in miscommunication, right? I don't think I need to try to substantiate that point, because we've all been in relationships with people that we love and we've gotten irritated with each other because somebody said something and I took it away that they didn't intend. There was a miscommunication, and as a result of that miscommunication, feelings were hurt, tempers flared, things were then said, arguments ensued. Conflict, all because we just didn't understand exactly what the other person was trying to say. And that happens when we're all speaking the same language, English, right? Have you ever tried to talk to somebody or communicate with somebody who speaks a different language than you? It's not easy. In fact, sometimes it can be rather frustrating. I remember when I was a sophomore in high school, I got my first job working at Culver's. And several of the other folks that were hired along with me to open up this new store in town were Hispanic folks. Hard workers. But I couldn't understand a lick of what they were saying. And that was all okay until somebody's order got messed up. And now in the front you're trying to communicate to the kitchen what needs to be corrected, and you're speaking two different languages. And I kind of wish I had paid a little bit more attention in Spanish class my freshman year, and I wouldn't have had to learn Spanish on the job. But before I learned how to speak some rudimentary Spanish, I mean, it was really difficult to just explain, nope, they're supposed to have fries with that. So understanding and speaking the same language with those you're trying to communicate with is vitally important to successful and meaningful communication. You know, the Apostle Paul understood this principle clearly. If you turn over in your Bibles to 1 Corinthians chapter 14, Paul has this discussion here with the Corinthian church about the exercising of miraculous spiritual gifts. And apparently there was a contingency within the church at Corinth who thought that the miraculous gift of speaking in tongues somehow made you really important. It was a pretty showy gift, this ability to speak in other languages. But notice what Paul says to the brethren here in 1 Corinthians chapter 14, beginning in verse 1. He says, "Pursue love, yet desire earnestly spiritual gifts, but especially that you may prophesy. For the one who speaks in a tongue does not speak to men, but to God. For no one understands, but in his spirit he speaks mysteries. But one who prophesies speaks to men for edification and exhortation and consolation. And one who speaks in a tongue edifies himself, but one who prophesies edifies the church. Now, I wish that you all spoke in tongues, but even more that you would prophesy." And notice this, "Greater is the one who prophesies than the one who speaks in tongues, unless he interprets so that the church may receive edifying. But now, brethren, if I come to you speaking in tongues, what will I profit you unless I speak to you either by way of revelation or of knowledge or of prophecy or of teaching? And yet even lifeless things, either flute or harp, in producing a sound, if they do not produce a distinction in the tones, how will it be known what is played on the flute or on the harp? For if the bugle produces an indistinct sound, who will prepare himself for battle? So also you, unless you utter by the tongue speech that is clear, how will it be known what is spoken? For you'll be speaking into the air. There are perhaps a great many kinds of languages in the world, and no kind is without meaning. If then I do not know the meaning of the language, I'll be to the one who speaks a barbarian, and the one who speaks will be a barbarian to me. So also you, since you're zealous for spiritual gifts, seek to abound for the edification of the church. Therefore, let one who speaks in a tongue pray that he may interpret. For if I pray in a tongue, my spirit prays, but my mind is unfruitful. What's the outcome then? Well, I'll pray with the spirit and I'll pray with the mind also. I'll sing with the spirit and I'll sing with the mind also. Otherwise, if you bless in the spirit only, how will the one who fills the place of the ungifted say the amen at your giving of thanks, since he does not know what you are saying? For you've given thanks well enough, but the other person is not edified. I thank God I speak in tongues more than you all. However, in the church, I desire to speak five words with my mind so that I may instruct others also rather than 10,000 words in a tongue. Now, sometimes we get the wrong idea about what this gift of tongues is. We think that it's some angelic language or something like that. It's not what the gift of tongues was in the first century. The gift of tongues was not some incoherent babbling. It was the ability to speak another human language that you didn't know, that you hadn't been trained to speak formally. So it'd be like me today, standing here before you, and all of a sudden being able to speak perfect Mandarin, even though I haven't the slightest idea of what that even sounds like. That's what's happening here. And so every time you read speaking in a tongue, I want you to think about speaking in another language that's unknown to those who are hearing. Okay? Now, in evangelism, that would be a very beneficial tool. When you travel somewhere else and you don't know the language that those people speak natively, but God enables you to communicate with them and deliver the gospel message in their native tongue. That would be beneficial. But when we're all here and we all speak the same language, Paul's point is, it's kind of a useless gift. Who cares if I can speak perfect German or perfect Spanish or Portuguese if you all don't understand that language? And so he's making the observation throughout this section that speaking in these other languages that are unknown to hearers are pointless and far inferior to any other spiritual gift that would impart meaningful information to the hearer, that would exhort or edify or console or instruct the hearer. You may be saying, he says, you may be saying a lot of good things. But if no one understands what you're saying because you're speaking them in another language that the audience doesn't know, how can they be built up by what you say? Well, the answer is they can't, because it sounds like gibberish to them. In fact, he says you might as well be a barbarian. And not that you are, what you're saying is barbarous or violent or crude or stupid or unintelligent. In fact, what you're saying may be helpful and true, The problem is that it's spoken in a foreign, unintelligible language to the one with whom you're speaking, and therefore it's a waste of breath, Paul says. You're speaking into the air. So saying, speaking, teaching, and instructing all of the right things in Mandarin or Russian or Portuguese isn't going to be of any benefit to us because we don't speak those languages. We speak and we hear and we understand English. And so the information being relayed, as good as it may be, isn't going to get from the speaker to the hearer due to the language barrier. And that's why Paul says in verse 19, I would rather speak five words with my mind, that is, five words that could be understood by the hearer, than 10,000 words spoken in an unintelligible language to the hearer. Because those five words that could be understood will do more benefit than 10,000 words that have no meaning to the hearer. Now, we can see this reality clearly when it comes to speech, our verbal communication. People come from different backgrounds. They come from different nations and different cultures, and they speak different native tongues or languages. And if we hope to have successful verbal communication with somebody who speaks a different language natively, we're going to have to learn how to speak their language, or they're going to have to learn how to speak our native tongue. But if you knew multiple languages, you would be able to communicate better with people who spoke those other languages. But if the hearer and the speaker only speak their native language, their first primary language, then meaningful communication can hardly even occur. What's interesting to me, guys, is that this same principle of speaking a common language in order to adequately communicate information, it applies to the way we speak, not just our words, that is verbal communication or speech, but to the way that we speak love to one another. Just as there are many languages in the world, spoken languages, there's also many love languages. That is, ways or methods in which love is communicated from one person to another. And just like the spoken word, we don't all speak the same love language. We each have a native tongue or a primary love language. And that means that the means and the methods, the modes of communicating love can differ from person to person. That is, we each have a preferred method or language that we speak and hear clearly when it comes to communicating love. And probably just like your native tongue, for us, English, you learned that growing up in your home and hearing mom and dad speak English and your siblings speak English, and your early environment, that was where you learned the English language. I would suggest to you that you probably learned your primary or native love language in that same environment. A lot of it has to do with the way that we were raised and what we saw being demonstrated by our parents. And because every family is different, we've all grown up speaking and becoming comfortable and familiar with different languages of love. We kind of get a glimpse of the fact that there are different ways to communicate love when we look at Paul's instructions to husbands and wives in Ephesians chapter 5. Read this text with me. Ephesians chapter 5. I want to start in verse 22. Paul says, "Wives, be subject to your own husbands as to the Lord." For the husband is the head of the wife, as Christ also is head of the church, he himself being the Savior of the body. But as the church is subject to Christ, so also the wives ought to be to their husbands in everything. Husbands, love your wives, just as Christ also loved the church and gave himself up for her, so that he might sanctify her, having cleansed her by the washing of water with the word, that he might present to himself the church in all her glory, having no spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that she would be holy and blameless. So husbands ought also to love their wives as their own bodies. And he who loves his own wife loves himself. For no one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it, just as Christ also does the church, because we are members of his body. And for this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother and shall be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. Now, this mystery is great, but I'm speaking with reference to Christ and the church. Nevertheless, and notice verse 33, this is where he sums it up. Nevertheless, each individual among you also is to love his own wife, even as himself, and the wife must see to it that she respects her husband. What we actually have here in this text, I believe, is not that Paul is telling husbands to do one thing towards their wives, love them, and wives, do something different towards your husbands, respect them. What he's doing here is he's telling husbands and wives, this is how you show your spouse that you love them. For the wives, he says, I want you to respect your husband. I want you to follow his lead. I want you to support his endeavors. I want you to be that helper who's suitable for him, as Eve was created to be the helpmeet to Adam in Genesis chapter 2. Husbands, on their part, are to show their wives love by self-sacrificial service. The way that Christ sacrificed himself for the church is held up as the model. Husbands, you want to know how to show your wives love? Sacrifice yourself for them. Protect them. Make them feel safe. Nourish them. Cherish them. Make them feel like they are a part of you. Now, if you don't think, ladies, that respecting your man communicates love to him, I would challenge you this afternoon to go home and ask him, which would you rather have, hon? Would you rather me love you or respect you? And I can almost guarantee that your man will tell you, I'd rather you respect me than love me. In fact, you can take it a step further. You could ask him this question, hon, would you feel like I love you if I was being disrespectful to you? And again, I can almost guarantee that every man sitting here today would say something like, how could I feel that you love me if you don't even respect me? Because there's a difference in the way that men and women communicate love. In a man's mind, respect is almost synonymous with love. I know my wife loves me because she's respectful to me. The times where I feel the least loved are the times where I feel that I'm being disrespected as a man. Now, I don't want to speak for women, but it would be an interesting exercise, guys, to go home and ask your wives, hun, what would you rather have? For me to love you, nourish you, cherish you, protect you, or to just have a healthy dose of respect for you as a person? Ladies, what do you think? What means more to you? See, and I think that that helps us to understand this point that I'm trying to make, is that we don't all communicate love. That is, we don't all speak love the same way. We don't all hear and interpret love the same way. We don't all demonstrate love the same way naturally. We speak different love languages. I think God, in His providence and His wisdom, knew that men were not going to naturally want to do the cherishing and the nourishing and all of that self-sacrificial stuff to give their wives that sense of security. And so that's why He says here, husbands, I want to make sure you do that. Oftentimes, God, through Scripture, reveals to us through His instruction the very thing that we naturally struggle with. Wives, be submissive to your husbands. I'll respect him when he's worthy of respect, when he's earned it. Any of you ever said that? Be honest. You thought that, at least, I know. It doesn't come natural. That's why God tells us that's what we're supposed to do. I've been reading a book. In fact, I've been reading several books by this Dr. Gary Chapman. The original book that he wrote is entitled The Five Love Languages, The Secret to Love That Lasts. And it's written from the perspective of talking to husbands and wives and how to communicate love effectively within the marriage relationship. But the principles that he lays down in this book about how to communicate love reach far beyond the marriage relationship. In fact, he's written books about the five love languages of children and the five love languages of teenagers, the five love languages of singles. And I would suggest, I don't think he's written a book yet, but we could almost extrapolate the points that he makes here, the principles that he lays down, to the five love languages of the church family. Dr. Chapman suggests that all methods of communicating love can be categorized under one of five major umbrellas. And he calls them the five love languages. Let me just share with you very briefly what those are. The first is words of affirmation. A kind word that builds someone up. An encouraging cheer, rooting someone on to the finish line. A respectful dialogue with someone. You know, a spoken, I love you. I'm proud of you. You're the best. I'm so thankful that I know you and that you're a part of my life. Words that express the feeling one has inside. Now, if this is your primary love language, these words are going to scream to you that the person who's saying them loves you. And we all like it when people say nice stuff to us. But if this is your primary love language, you're going to just really thrive and feel this huge boost when somebody says a kind word to you. The second language is acts of service. Doing the chores, cleaning the house, making dinner, cutting the grass, working hard to provide for your family. You know, and again, we all like it when somebody pitches in and helps out, right? It makes the work go a little bit faster. It makes the load seem a little bit less to bear. But when acts of service is your primary love language, when someone pitches in and helps, it makes you feel loved. Another language is gifts, both giving and receiving gifts. And it's interesting, this is probably one of the most basic ways in which we, as a human people, show love to others. By giving them things. It's prevalent in almost every culture, every custom across the globe, to give gifts. Ironically, this is the one that I'm the worst at. And it becomes even more apparent to me as I'm trying to come up with some ideas of some things to illustrate what gifts looks like in love language. I'm trying to do better. I think one of the traps, though, that we find ourselves in, if this doesn't come naturally to us, is we think, man, gifts, that's going to be an expensive love language. I don't know if my bank account can handle speaking that love language all the time. But what we need to understand about gifts is it's not about how much the gift costs. In fact, they don't have to cost very much at all. In fact, they don't even have to come from a store. They could be things like a handwritten note in your lunch pail, or a homemade card that says, I love you. And we might think, well, isn't that just the same thing as saying the words? No, because there's a gift attached to it. And oftentimes it's, you know, we say sometimes it's the thought that counts. And that's really what's at the core of this love language. It's not always so much the gift itself, but it's what that gift represents. Now, that's not to say, well, I had the thought, I just didn't get the gift. That should be good enough. No, the gift has to actually be, or the thought has to actually be expressed through the gift. But it can be something simple. When I come home in the afternoon, and I bring a little Dunkin' Donuts coffee to Steph, me handing her that cup of coffee screams, I love you, more louder than I could ever scream, I love you. Because when she gets that, she says, I know he was thinking about me today because he grabbed me this thing on his way out. And so it's those kinds of things that, for some people, it really just screams, I love you, and speaks it louder than any other way. Something tangible that they can hold on to. A reminder that you love them. The fourth love language is quality time. And understand, it's not quantity time, okay? It's quality time. That is giving someone your undivided attention, really listening to them, being present for them and with them. Husbands, for us, that may be sitting and listening intently to how things have gone for our wives during the day. Not with the attitude of, all right, I'm going to analyze this, I'm going to solve the problem, and I'm going to give her the solution. Don't do that. Just shut up and listen. Sometimes, though, it is simply just being together, going on a walk or a bike ride, or maybe helping out, working together, getting your hands dirty together, planting flowers or doing some project around the house. You know, for me, oftentimes when I'm out working in the garage, even if I'm just cleaning up out there, I like Steph to be around. She doesn't have to be helping me clean either. Just having her there. The last one is physical touch. It could be a hug, a kiss, a pat on the back, an arm around your shoulder. There's nothing more comforting sometimes than a warm embrace of a friend. And if that's your primary love language, then you feel loved even without a word ever being spoken. Just as there are different dialects to the English language, so too each of the five love languages have many different dialects. So what I've shared with you very briefly this morning is truly the 30,000-foot overview and just a small sampling of the many different dialects of each of the five love languages. We're going to have to flesh out each of the languages in more detail in a future study, where I will hopefully show you not only that these are ways which we can communicate love to one another, but actually that this concept and the concept of all five of these love languages is actually biblically based. That is, it's rooted in the way that God has instructed us to love others, and how God himself has shown us his love. But even as I just briefly related the five different love languages to you this morning, as I was talking about each one, I would venture to guess that one language resonated with you more than the others. And I would also venture to guess that the same one didn't resonate with all of us. That is, we each, just as we each have our native tongue, English, we've all probably learned a different primary native love language as we've grown up. Not only is that the language that we hear the most easily, but it's probably the language that we tend to speak or demonstrate towards others most frequently. But the problem is that whatever your native or primary love language is, it's not the same for everyone else. You know, for some of you, when I was talking about acts of service, cooking dinner and having a clean house, some of you guys might have thought to yourself, yeah, I know my wife loves me because she does those things. But some of them just don't ring the same way to all of us. What's interesting, unfortunately, is that some of them tend to conflict with one another. If you, as a husband, speak acts of service as your primary love language, you probably view going out and working hard and long hours providing for your family as your demonstration of love for your wife and your kids. But if you have a wife or kids whose primary love language is quality time, you can see how those two can conflict with one another. And so what you think you're saying sometimes is not actually what's being communicated to the one who you're talking to. So as we seek, I want us to try to make some application over the coming weeks to ourselves as a congregation, as a spiritual family. And as we seek to communicate and speak love to one another, we need to ask ourselves, are we speaking a foreign love language or one that can be understood by the one I'm talking to? Because if we're speaking a foreign love language, then we may be speaking love well enough, but the one or ones to whom we're seeking to communicate our love, they're not hearing it. Well, they hear it, but they're not interpreting it. They don't understand it, because it's like you're speaking in a foreign language. If we speak only our native love language, you may feel good about it after you've done it, but nobody else does, because they don't understand what you're saying. And just as Paul pointed out there in 1 Corinthians 14 about if the trumpet doesn't make a distinct sound, who's going to prepare themselves for battle? If you don't speak love distinctly in a language that can be understood by those who you're trying to speak it to, don't be surprised when they don't respond to your expression of love. And though, just as there are a great many number of languages on earth, and all of them have meaning, so too there are a lot of love languages, none of which are without meaning. But if I don't know the meaning, then we're like barbarians to one another. Your demonstration of love may be legitimate and genuine and heartfelt and real, but if the one whom you're trying to speak love to does not understand your love language, how could there be any edifying or building up? And I think understanding a little bit about the five love languages and being able to communicate efficiently in all five is going to help us as a congregation to effectively communicate the love not only that we're supposed to have, but that I believe we do have for one another, to one another. We will enable one another not just to be able to know intellectually, yeah, I know that you love me, but also to feel emotionally the love that we have for one another. Again, it's because we don't all share the same native tongue, the same primary love language. And because of that, it sometimes leads to miscommunication, doesn't it? Or maybe a breakdown or failure in communication. And we think, I'm telling you that I love you as loud as I can, but I'm speaking in a different language. I need to figure out what your love language is and try to communicate to you in a way that you understand. So, let's try to speak love effectively to one another.